Over these past few months, we've been hearing more stories of sexual harassment. It's hard to come forward under any circumstance, but if you're in prison, coming forward is even more daunting.
First, you are typically transferred away from the prison that you've been in. The second sort of problem you have is you will often be viewed as a snitch, both by guards and by other prisoners.
Plus, how does climate change affect farmers, especially in the Midwest? Here's one soybean farmer in Missouri.
See how that's rotted right there? Whenever they lay in water, or they might sprout, and then they'll just instantly kind of turn brown and just rot right there in the ground.
And does your dog really need a winter coat or a wool sweater to stay warm? We're going to answer that question ahead. But first, the deadline to sign up for health insurance through the Affordable Care Act is this Friday. We'll give you the rundown on everything you need to know. That's all coming up on this hour of the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. The end of the year is quickly approaching, and in addition to holiday planning and crossing things off your work to-do list, there's one major deadline to look out for: signing up for health care insurance. Come Friday at 11 p.m., you'll no longer be able to pick a health care plan for next year through the online marketplace that was created through the Affordable Care Act. But before you head over to getcovered.illinois.gov, we want to make sure that you have all the information necessary to be a savvy shopper. Joining me now is Lisha Schenk, a healthcare business reporter at the Chicago Tribune, and Barbara Otto, CEO of the organization Smart Policy Works. Both are on the line from Chicago. Welcome back to the 21st.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
So, Lisa, can you start off by reminding us who is eligible to sign up for health insurance, and who does this December 15th deadline really affect the most?
Sure. Most people in Illinois get health insurance coverage through their employers or government programs like Medicare and Medicaid.
Right.
This is for people who are not in those categories, who are looking to buy individual insurance policies for themselves.
Okay, so the ACA deadline was moved up from last year. This has kind of caused or been a source of confusion. In 2016, people had until the end of January, but now you only have until the end of this week. Could you give us a sense of why that deadline was moved up and a little context there?
Sure. It was something, as I understand, that was under consideration in previous years as well. But this year, the Trump administration went ahead and moved that deadline up. And so now people have about half as much time to sign up this year. And as I talk to advocates, people trying to raise awareness of the sign-up, it seems like that's the biggest challenge. It's just getting people to understand that they don't have as much time this year to sign up as they did in years previous.
Right. So, but was there a politics reason, a policy reason, just a logistics reason for that deadline being moved up, that conversation even starting before the Trump administration?
I know one of the reasons I've heard is maybe to make it so that to make the market a little bit more stable in terms of making sure that people weren't waiting until they got sick to sign up,
okay,
making the window a little shorter so that people just had to sign up right away and not go, okay, it's January 15th and apparently I'm not in good health, so I'll go ahead and sign up. And they're trying to get a good balance of healthy and sick people into the marketplace.
Okay. Well, Barbara, in that idea of people signing up, do you have a sense of where those numbers are so far this year? Obviously, they might spike between now and Friday, but how's enrollment looking in particular here in Illinois?
Well, in Illinois, we've heard that we're right on schedule and actually a little bit further ahead than we were last year.
Really?
At this time, but I'm hearing that mostly from, I don't have updated figures as of today, but I am hearing from people who are doing the enrollment that they are booked solid, that they're getting lots of phone calls. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody who's contacting them is indeed eligible for the marketplace, and I think the other thing to know is, well, we have 350,000 people enrolled in health insurance through the exchange. There are going to be lots of people who are going to be just automatically re-enrolled, and there are going to be people who maybe experience what is called special enrollment periods, which is something we haven't really talked about yet, simply because their plan was discontinued. So they're going to have a little more time to pick a plan.
So can you remind us who exactly is eligible versus who is not, since we're on that topic right now?
Who for special enrollment periods?
Well, in general, for the marketplace, okay. And then if sure. you'd like to hit on the special enrollment.
Sure. As Lisa just said, you know, the majority of people in the state of Illinois get their health insurance through their employer or through their spouse's employer or partner's employer. But in Illinois, if you make above 138% of the federal poverty level and do not receive health insurance through your employer, you're eligible to enroll in the marketplace. And okay. you can go to Get Covered Illinois, and you can either click on a link to get help in selecting a plan, or you can call 1-866-311-1119 to get help on the phone.
So it's really nice that you mentioned it there, because I was kind of curious. This isn't like Amazon, so it can be kind of daunting through this online browsing process looking for insurance. So you're saying that there are helplines available, there are ways to get help through the website, but what should people be looking for when they're on this website, quote, shopping for healthcare plans?
Well, I always recommend people have a list of not only the physician they like to see or the community hospital or hospital they want to go to, but they also have a list of their prescription drugs if they take okay. them or any specialists, and that they go online and they look, and that they also take the time to perhaps get on the phone and call their physician or call the hospital to make sure that the plan they select has them in network, because the directories are changing all the time. And if you want to make sure, it's usually best to make a phone call.
So, Lisa, there are different tiers of plans, right? I understand there's gold plans, silver plans, bronze plans. What are the differences when you're looking at these tiers?
Different deductibles, different premiums, different potentially levels of coverage. And that's one of the reasons that I'm being told it's really important for people to shop around this year in particular, because there have been some changes made at the federal level, and the state of Illinois has reacted in a certain way that they're trying to take the cost pressure off of people because of some of the changes to some of the rules surrounding Obamacare this year. And so there are, for some people, gold plans this year, which are considered the highest level plan, might actually be cheaper than a lower level plan just because of these changes. And so that's one of the reasons that it's important for people to get out there and really look and compare premiums and deductibles and networks, because just because something is a higher level this year doesn't necessarily mean it will be more expensive for that person after they get a tax credit, depending on their income.
Certainly a good distinction to make. Is there mainly all this uncertainty around the talk of an ACA repeal then?
There is uncertainty. Oh, go ahead.
Why don't we go to Lisa first, then we'll go to Barbara.
Yeah.
Sure, there is uncertainty around the repeal. Certainly right now there's a lot of talk about potentially as part of the tax bill, getting rid of the individual mandate, which is the requirement that everyone get insurance or pay a penalty. The rates are pretty much set for next year, but there are questions about whether if this requirement that everyone buy insurance or pay a penalty goes away, whether how much that might affect insurers, whether insurers might drop out of the marketplace eventually,
okay.
whether rates might go up for 2019. So there is uncertainty around that.
And in Illinois, the Department of Insurance really tried to work with the health plans in the marketplace to try to bake in to the rates, you know, any potential changes in cost sharing, because I know that has been something that's been in the news, that Congress wants to eliminate mm-hmm. subsidies or cost sharing. And so to stabilize the market, the state of Illinois really tried to be proactive on that.
Well, and as we're finding here just in this conversation, it's hard to talk about healthcare without talking about politics. As you guys have both referenced, the recent tax bill passed in the Senate would repeal the Affordable Care Act's individual mandate. But as it stands, you are required still right now to have health insurance or you would incur that penalty. I imagine there's a lot of rhetoric and confusion about where things stand and where this particular enrollment period falls in. What to do. So if people are out there thinking, do I need to get a health care plan? Am I going to be penalized? Should they still go and sign up? I'm assuming there's so much confusion over that next year.
I would count on having an individual mandate. They've tried to repeal and replace the ACA time and time again. I just think it's important to kind of stick with what the letter of the law is today instead of predicting what this Congress or this administration might be able to do between now and January 1.
Certainly. And
I know I had...
Go ahead.
I know I had a broker tell me that it's probably best to just for people to go ahead and buy plans now based on the current law, and if mm-hmm. the law changes and someone feels strongly that they don't need one, they can always cancel later, but it might be it's difficult to buy later, but you can always cancel later.
Oh, that's very good to know. So, Barbara, outside of avoiding that particular penalty, are there other benefits to signing up right now, especially meaning today versus waiting until Friday afternoon, for example?
Well, if you're signing up today and getting help today, you have more time to make sure that your providers of choice are in the plans that you're looking at. So that's one advantage to begin looking today. I think another advantage is why I would encourage everyone to enroll is a lot of the proposals that Congress took a look at talked about penalizing individuals who went without coverage.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really important to keep in mind you really can't go wrong by signing up today. It's a lapse in coverage, many of the proposals that Congress was looking at, that would cause an even higher premium than anybody who had continuous coverage. So today, if you haven't taken a look, I would start looking today. And keep in mind, if you are one of the refugees from one of the storms, from the hurricane, either in Texas, Florida, or Puerto Rico, mm-hmm. and you happen to be up here in Illinois, you will get something called a special enrollment period if you miss the deadline by Friday. And you should just call healthcare.gov or go online and make sure that you let them know you were in a FEMA a certified area. So
will there be a special window for the special enrollment for those individuals, or they will just get an extra extension?
You get an extra extension. You get an extra 60 days.
Oh, okay. So, Lisa, I believe you might have mentioned this a few points ago, so I want to bring it back. Once you signed up for health insurance, you were saying that it's easier to sign up now because you can get out of it later, so you're not locked in, or am I misunderstanding that?
I mean, if you stop paying your premiums in 2018 at some point, then you won't have coverage anymore if you stop paying them for a certain amount of time. And so I know that's what one broker told me when I asked him, what should people do amid all these potential changes in the law? He said, sign up now based on what the law is now, and then you have coverage if the law doesn't change, and if someone feels very strongly in 2018 that they don't want this coverage anymore and the penalty's gone away for not having it, you know, that person could, in theory, stop paying their premiums next year.
So, Barbara, what have you been hearing from people during this enrollment period? Is there a greater sense of urgency? I know you mentioned that the numbers are up, but is that because of what we're talking about here, this uncertain future regarding healthcare, or are you seeing trends in other directions?
I'm still the one thing I've always been concerned about is people who never enrolled, who were eligible and potentially could get help. I think we've done a pretty good job this year in not only going after the 350,000 people to try to make sure that they know that the enrollment period is condensed, and they also know that there are some challenges. You know, for example, healthcare.gov has been down on certain Sundays for maintenance, and the state of Illinois really stepped in by making sure people could go on Get Covered Illinois to get enrolled. And so there's been some really good sort of outreach with very limited dollars, because the federal government did cut dollars for paid help out in the field to help people re-enroll. I'm still hearing a lot from people, though, who are saying they didn't think they were eligible for any kind of help because they misunderstand that that you can be above the poverty level and get help paying for premiums. I'm also hearing a lot from people that their plans are not being continued, or the health insurance carriers that they're used to receiving their coverage from have different benefits packages and different plans at a higher price point.
Okay.
And so people are really confused.
Well, Lisa, we only have about a minute here, but I'm curious, as someone who's following the healthcare industry, what are some of the big questions you're thinking about as far as the future of the Affordable Care Act going forward?
I think one of the big questions in everyone's mind is, if this tax bill repeals the individual mandate, what is that going to mean? There are some people saying that it might not really damage the law that much, because people maybe are not already not super inspired by the penalty to gain coverage. Like, the penalty may not be the main driver anyway behind people getting coverage. And then there are people saying that it might devastate the law, mm-hmm. because then you're going to have healthy people not signing up. You're going to have mostly sick people signing up, and that makes it financially very difficult for insurers,
right,
to continue offering coverage.
Right. Well, individuals have until Friday at 11 p.m. to sign up for health insurance through the Affordable Care Act marketplace. And we are hearing that you should definitely go do that, even amongst the confusion and concern of the future. For more information, you can visit getcovered.illinois.gov. Lisa, Barbara, I want to thank you so much for joining us. Coming up later on the 21st, how climate change affects farmers, and does your dog really need a winter coat? Send us your warm pet pics at 21STShow. That's later on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. For months now, we've been hearing more and more people come forward with stories of sexual assault and sexual harassment. We know it can be extremely difficult to share those stories with anyone, whether it's a friend, a family member, or with someone in a position of authority like your boss or the local law enforcement. But imagine you have to share that story while in prison. Officially, the Bureau of Justice Statistics says 80,000 people are sexually abused in jails and prisons nationwide. And that number is most certainly higher because sexual assaults are often underreported. And if a perpetrator is a corrections officer or someone else in authority, that can put the survivor at even bigger disadvantage and risk. Earlier this year, the Uptown People's Law Center in Chicago sued the Illinois Department of Corrections over the case of Strawberry Hampton. She's a trans woman who was sexually assaulted several times by a corrections officer. We'll learn more about that case in just a few minutes. But first, I want to welcome Celia Colon. She is a youth advocate and a mentor. She lives in Chicago, and she joins me on the line. Celia, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Celia, I understand that you were incarcerated in Cook County Jail from 1994 to 2002, and that you're a survivor of an assault that took place while you were there. Can you tell us your story of what happened?
Sure. You see, I am one of the many faces of prison rape victims. This horrible rape culture was alive in 95 when I was there, and still very alive today in every jail and prison system all over the United States. I can never delete what was done to me from my heart, my mind, and my soul. I must live with the impact of this for the rest of my life, just like many others. we also have to live with the fact that we will never get justice for this crime, especially those doing a lot of time. Because, you see, there's also a statute of limitation to report a rape when there shouldn't be. These monsters that abuse their power have total control. There's a huge, huge code of silence behind these walls of torture where officers cover up for each other, turn a blind eye to what's happening, and they just get moved around from one place to another.
So could you, if you don't mind me asking, could you share who your perpetrator was? Was it a corrections officer?
It was a correctional officer from the Cook County Jail, and he raped a lot of victims. I even watched him rape one of my cellmates.
Wow. Well, I want to first thank you for sharing your story with us. I know this can't be easy. Could you take us through what happened in the weeks and months right after the assault?
After the assault, it continued for a while, and then I was shipped out to the prison system. So once I was there, there was a lot of times that I was sexually harassed, almost raped in Dixon, which is was a co-ed prison back then.
So were you
a seg unit?
Were you transferred because you came forward with your story, or was
no,
that?
No, I was 18 years old fighting a crime of my own, and I was convicted, and I was transferred.
Okay.
To do my prison sentence, I was given 15 years for a crime that I committed.
So while you were incarcerated and this assault has happened, did you feel that there was anyone that you could talk to or that there were any official channels that you could go through to file a complaint at that time?
Oh, no. There was nothing in place. I was locked up in 94. The PREA, which is the Prison Rape Elimination Act, was signed into law September 4th of 2003. This was like the first attempt to address the rape culture in the prison systems. But, you know, it really has never been it's never been mandated in every private and public jail and prison system. It does not protect the abused victim against retaliation while you're locked up. You know, there's tons of torture that takes place if you do come forward. There's nothing in place. There's no anti-rape strategies. There's no accountability for the people who abuse their power and for their actions. There's no counseling, there's no, you know, crisis response team. There's nothing available. And even when you come home, nothing is done, you know, to prevent these crimes from happening. Mm-hmm. There's no policies. And it's a very vulnerable group that has been forgotten about. Many who don't even belong there, who are just victims of themselves of mass incarceration, which only affect the Black and Brown communities. You know I will never get justice for what was done to me, but if I can prevent or protect someone else from this horrible injustice, then that'll be my justice. Standing up and using my voice to protect other people, I'm willing to be the poster child. I'm willing to open up my life and share what has happened to me because it's continuing to happen. And we must end the rape culture. If we find the right people who are strong enough and care enough, there's a lot of things that can get put in place to end this.
Mm-hmm. Celia, as we said earlier, and we've been talking a lot about this, we've been hearing more and more stories about sexual assault and harassment with the Me Too movement, of course, in a different setting. But how does this make you feel personally, and how does it make you feel for the future of rape culture or just assault and harassment in general?
Well, it actually, when people started getting justice for what was happening to them 15, 20 years ago, this made me want to take action, but because of statutes of limitations, I cannot.
Oh, okay.
So therefore, I'm willing to be the poster child. I'm willing to stand in front of legislators. I'm willing to connect with anyone who's willing to help me pass bills and change legislative to take a look and open up this conversation that is happening, you know, inside these walls of torture. There's just so much to address, and there's so much that can be put in place to prevent it. We just have to have people that care enough and that want to help. And, you know, I just want to be able to create that change and help people deal with trauma, because a lot of people who come home from the prison systems are just trying to figure out how to make it out here with
right.
this scar on their back. Then they have to come home with traumas that you didn't even go in there with at times. And, you know, trauma really impacts your ability to think. You know, we have a bridge that connects our right and left hemispheres called the corpus callosum. And this bridge must connect for learning and thinking. When trauma impacts you, it disrupts your ability to think. It disrupts your body function, and that bridge never connects. So when we are always in that flight or fight kind of state, the cortisol levels are up. Our bodies are not always meant to be in that state and meant to live like that, and a lot of us do. And that's a big part of the oppression that we're not talking about is mental health, a conversation that should be on everybody's mouth. And there's no help for nobody when they come home to deal with the trauma of what happened, whether they've seen people get killed, whether they see people commit suicide, whether they see people get beaten and raped. These are things that happen behind the wall. You are in a whole different world of just a very hostile environment, and you're in this flight or fight state, and then you come home and you're expected to be normal and have no kind of social safety nets put in place in the most poorest communities. So I'm willing to do whatever I have to do to move this forward and to see, you know, what doors can open up for the people that have no voices.
That's Celia Colon. She lives in Chicago. She's a youth advocate and mentor, and she's been sharing her story of what happened to her while she was incarcerated in Cook County Jail. Celia, I just want to thank you so much for sharing your story today.
Thank you.
I now want to welcome Alan Mills to the conversation. He is the executive director of the Uptown People's Law Center. Alan, welcome back to the 21st. So we just heard Celia's story, and as she said, this happened years ago, but she's still carrying it with her to this day. Does her story ring true and familiar to you and the experiences you've had with people you've interacted with?
Sadly, yes, and I wish this was history that happened 15 years ago, but it's happening today in our Illinois prisons and other prisons across the country, but right here in Illinois. So this is not ancient history. This is not something that the Prison Rape Elimination Act solved. It is an ongoing problem.
So as we've been talking about, women are sharing a lot of these kinds of stories right now throughout different areas and environments within our culture. But a group that really hasn't been at the forefront of that conversation is transgendered people. So I want to ask you a little bit more about a recent case that you and the Uptown People's Law Center are working on. You're asking for a court order to protect a trans woman named Strawberry Hampton after she was sexually assaulted by corrections officers in a men's prison. Can you tell us more about what's going on there?
Yes. So her ordeal started when some correctional officers at Pinckneyville decided that it would be entertaining to have her put on a sex show for them. She did briefly, you know, as a self-preservation sort of thing, but then quickly said, this is not something I should be doing, and said she wasn't going to do it anymore. They threatened her. She made a report through the PREA, the Prison Rape Elimination Act hotline, which is exactly what she's supposed to do. But rather than taking that complaint seriously, her complaints immediately got back to her harassers, and that simply upped the ante so that they very significantly ramped up the harassment, both physically and mentally, name-calling, some use of force against her, and most damningly, they wrote a series of false disciplinary reports, which sent her to solitary. Eventually, that got her transferred to Menard Correctional Center, a maximum security prison, where she had hoped it's the worst prison, and needed to be away from her tormentors. However, as soon as she got off the bus, they made it clear to her that they knew exactly who she was, that she was there because, as the guards put it, she snitched on other guards, and that she would be sorry. And sadly, the harassment has gotten much worse at Menard.
So, Alan, I fear that we might be losing you. So
I'm here.
Oh, there we got you.
Sorry.
No, you're fine. I don't know that we have the best connection right now, but we did lose you there at the end.
I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
So sadly, things got worse at Menard. The use of physical force was ramped up, and she continues to be stuck in solitary where she has been since this summer.
So I do want to point out right now that we did reach out to the Illinois Department of Corrections, and they did send us a statement that said the department takes these and all allegations of sexual misconduct seriously and takes an aggressive approach to ensure all facilities are compliant with the national standards of the Prison Rape Elimination Act. The department carefully considers housing and works with a committee comprised of medical, mental health, and security professionals when making placement for offenders who identify as transgender. So, Alan, we've mentioned or we've heard from both you and Celia, the Prison Rape Elimination Act. We've made a few passing comments. It was passed in 2003. But can you give us a better sense of this law and what are these national standards that the Department of Corrections is referring to here?
Well, they're very long and detailed. But to summarize them, what they do is establish on paper anyway, a zero tolerance for not only sexual assault, but for sexual harassment of any sort.
Okay.
And it has all kinds of rules about where people have to be housed, no retaliation against them when they make a complaint. You can't send people to solitary anymore because they make a complaint of being sexually harassed or assaulted.
Mm-hmm.
But all that's on paper. And what's really happening in the department is that not a lot has changed since the days when Celia was in prison. And as is often the case in the department, there's a gap between what's on a piece of paper as to what the written policy is and
okay.
what actually happens at cell phone. And that's been the problem with that throughout the department, not just with sexual abuse, but with a wide variety of things. Often the written policies are very good, but by
mm-hmm.
the time it gets to cell phone, it's the same old thing that's been happening for a generation.
So building on that, we obviously know that these stories, they can be hard to talk about in any setting, in any environment. But
right.
even if you aren't incarcerated, but for people in prison, it has to be extra difficult. So can you speak to the additional barriers to coming forward?
Well, yeah. I mean, in prison, your entire life is in the hands of a correctional officer.
Mm-hmm.
When or whether you get fed, when you get out of your cell, who you're going to be housed with, even whether or not you have access to running water and toilets to flush. All of those are controlled by the very people who you have to make the complaint against. So making that complaint
mm-hmm.
is in and of itself opening yourself up for extreme retaliation, much more so than would ever happen on the outside. People on the outside are free, and therefore, you know, they're not under the control of the state 24 hours a day, and they're not under the control of their abusers 24 hours a day.
Right. It puts
That's
that whole authority and power thing at a whole new level. As
absolutely.
Far as your day-to-day.
Absolutely, the potential for retaliation is much higher inside. There's also a real stigma among both prisoners and guards for snitching inside.
Mm-hmm.
So the very fact that you have told on somebody opens you up to retaliation just for that.
Right.
And finally, the fact that you admit to being assaulted is taken as odd as this is, a admission of weakness. And that's a problem inside prison. So there are all kinds of barriers as to why nobody would ever report sexual assault. And there's very few reasons to do so other than you are desperate.
Well, and I can imagine this, all of this makes it very difficult to get any kind of accurate data within the four walls of a prison and assault, correct?
That is correct. And one of the things PREA did before the standards come out was to have as good a survey as ever been done. They did a series of anonymous surveys where people were taken to a room where they could fill out these surveys without anybody seeing what they're filling out, and they were submitted anonymously.
Okay.
So it got a pretty good picture. And I do want to say that the sort of cultural belief that people get raped in prison all the time is not true. I won't say that everybody who goes into prison is at risk of being raped. It's not like it's a day-to-day occurrence.
Mm-hmm.
But when it does happen, it's very serious, and it absolutely does happen.
Well, Alan, we just have about a minute left. So briefly, could you explain how you make it easier for people who have been assaulted to come forward, tell their stories, and perhaps get some sort of justice?
Well, I think it's all about transparency. We try to magnify their voices so that they not only get a hearing among the public, but in a courtroom where they are on an even keel, the idea of equal justice for all, means that the people they're accused have to come into court and answer questions under oath. It evens the playing field, something that does not happen inside of a prison ever. So in that sense, we hope that it's a very empowering thing for the victims.
That's Alan Mills. He's the executive director of the Uptown People's Law Center. Alan, I want to thank you for joining us for this conversation today.
And thank you for having the conversation today. It's such an important topic.
Absolutely. Up next on the 21st, climate change in Illinois in agriculture, and should your dog be wearing a winter coat? Thanks for listening. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. When times are tough for farmers, it affects everything from grocery store prices to the amount you pay at the gas station. And under expected climate change conditions, Illinois farmers will likely face wetter springs, hotter summers, and more crop-destroying pests. That's terrible news for farmers and bad news for everyone else, too. Jonathan Hettinger has been covering the impact of climate change on Illinois agriculture for the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting, an independent nonprofit newsroom based here in Champaign. He's joining us now from our studios in Urbana. Jonathan, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me again.
So, Jonathan, we hear a lot about climate change in the news, and it's oftentimes in this way off in the future abstract concept. But when it comes to farming, we're already seeing the impact of climate change here in Illinois, correct?
Yeah, so we're actually at the one of the warmest times in the historical record for Illinois. And so far, there's been a lot of really higher temperatures and then a lot of really intense rainfall in recent years that can come at some really bad times. So this year there's a lot of ponding in the fields, and that has happened in the past, but it's becoming a more and more frequent occurrence. And actually a study a few years ago found from the Illinois Institute for Government and Public Affairs found that Illinois' agriculture is going to be seeing a lot of effects, especially in the next 5 years.
Okay, and so looking to that 5 years, what are the ways that our state's agriculture sector could be affected by this climate change? For example, the crop-destroying insects or other areas?
Yeah, so, I mean, an increase in temperature and a shift in rain patterns are going to be the most significant things. So higher temperatures and then rain will come. The same amount of rain is expected to come, but it will come more frequently, or it will become less frequently, but much more, much bigger storms.
Concentrated.
Yes. And then there will be a lot more pests because milder winters make it easier for pests to survive. As the different types of mosquitoes are becoming more and more common farther north. And you can see that, you can have already seen that. And then also weeds are going to be able to better survive in the more mild winters.
Well, back to your point about rainfall, though. So everyone kind of assumes that plants need water. So why is it bad if we get a lot of water? They feel better, right? Or is that not the case?
Yeah. I mean, rain is great for plants, but when it all comes at once, it can help. It can actually hurt them because it would just drown them, or so it's beneficial, but it's beneficial throughout the season rather than in one intense flooding event.
And not just for the growth of the plant, I assume it also affects the planting and the planning of a field.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that is something that this year, I know there were some farmers in central Illinois who had to plant 3 or 4 times because they just kept getting ponding in their fields. It just kept raining, and then they would have to replant.
So we're a top corn and soybean state. I don't think anyone is going to disagree with that. Two major crops that we sell all over the world. And there's a lot of money at stake. So are Illinois farmers concerned about how climate change could affect them economically moving forward?
Well, so Jim Angel, the state climatologist, said that the people who ask him the most about climate change are farmers.
Really?
Because it affects their bottom line. But out of the farmers that I've talked to, a lot of the ones that they've said that, yes, this is something that they're concerned about, but the weather changes every year and it's always changed. So I don't know. I think you can see both sides of it where they are asking about it, but I'm not sure if they necessarily believe how much it will affect it compared to other changes in the past.
Well, speaking of both sides, if you'll allow me, I do want to play devil's advocate here for a second. So we've talked a little bit about the negative consequences in this conversation so far. Are there any positives that agriculture could get out of warmer weather or even more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere?
Well, so plants do benefit from a greater amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So they would grow bigger in the spring, mm-hmm. which would ideally make them have better yields, and in years where there's enough rain, that will happen. But researchers at the University of Illinois here found that while in ideal growing conditions, carbon dioxide boosts crop yields, in years of drought, the damage will offset those benefits because the plants will grow really big in the spring. And then in the summer, when there's less frequent rain, the plants will be more likely to die and they'll be more stressed because they actually need more water because they're bigger. So in years with a lot of water, that you could see a lot of benefit, but mm-hmm. in other years, maybe not, which also could lead to more irrigation, which is something that I have written about, just more and more irrigation of different types of crops in Illinois.
Which would be good or bad?
It's expensive for farmers to install those systems. Mm-hmm. And it's also the impacts of that are not entirely certain.
So if we're directly weighing or outweighing or comparing positives versus negatives, where do we land right now?
I would say, it's definitely a negative because in the next 5 to 25 years, yields are expected to go down 15%. I know when at an event that Jim Angel was talking at, he said that in the next half a century, Illinois will shift significantly. So like Champaign's atmosphere, their weather will be more like Carbondale's, which is a very significant change when it comes to growing corn and soybeans and things like that.
It's one state, but the climate can vary actually pretty dramatically from top to bottom. So let's switch from the farmer's perspective to, say, my perspective. I'm not a farmer, so what would climate change and its effects on agriculture mean for me, just an individual living in Illinois?
Well, if it's more expensive and farmers aren't able to get as good of a crop, then food could become more expensive. Then ethanol would become more expensive, which could increase your gas prices. You can also see the impact in kind of the public health way because there's going to be more mosquitoes in this area. There's going to be people who don't have air conditioning in their homes are going to see more extreme weather and more extreme heat, which is really bad for their health and things like that.
So when you're talking or looking towards prevention or fixes, is it too late to fend off some of the damage that's already been done? And are farmers doing anything right now to lessen the impacts that they are feeling at this moment?
Right now, I think that a lot of the big agribusiness companies, which we help cover at the Midwest Center, are doing a lot to try and kind of figure out how can we make crops that are drought resistant and that can tolerate more of this. Farmers, I think that they're just kind of trying to figure out how this is going to impact them. Irrigation in Illinois has increased 20% in the past 5 years. So you can kind of, and especially in Champaign County. I think that that's one impact that you're starting to see, though that kind of came out of the 2012 drought, which was one of the most extreme droughts in state history. But, I think that the big ag companies are definitely doing a lot to try and lessen their reliance on fossil fuels.
That's journalist Jonathan Hettinger from the Midwest Center for Investigative Reporting. For more on climate change and agriculture, in particular their reporting, you can visit the center's website at investigatemidwest.org. Jonathan, thanks so much for being with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. And speaking of temperatures, parkas for your pointer, jackets for your Jack Russell Terrier, sweaters for your Chihuahua, they're all adorable, but do dogs really need them? Now that winter is in full swing, we wanted to check in with Dr. Tony Kappa, a veterinarian at the Village Pet Doctor in Tolono, to find out how to keep your dog safe and warm out there, not to mention stylish. He joins me in our Urbana studios today. Tony, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having me.
So, Tony, winters in Illinois can bring temperatures down to well below zero. We've all experienced it, but it's understandable that dog owners might fear that they need to keep their pets warm, take extra measures. But do dogs really need something like a winter jacket or a sweater?
Well, it definitely depends on the type of dog you're dealing with. So if you have a small breed dog like a Chihuahua or something like that, it's definitely something you want to worry about. You know, the smaller dogs, they have a large surface area to kind of their volume, so they can lose a lot of heat because of that. And they tend to also have pretty short hair coats that don't insulate them from the cold. So if you have a small dog, it's definitely not a bad idea to have it on. Those larger breed dogs, definitely the Siberian breeds like Samoyeds and things like that, probably will do okay. You still need to be cautious, depending on, you know, use common sense judgment. If it's, you know, negative 20, obviously you wouldn't want to leave them out there for too long. But they should do fine. You know, it also depends on kind of what their normal habitat is. So if they're more an outdoor dog, they should be a little bit better equipped to handle that, because as the days get shorter, dogs are their hair coat gets longer. And so if you have a lot of dogs who are indoors, have a lot of not the natural light, they may not get that nice thick undercoat as a, you know, a large breed dog who's outside. So that could play a role as well.
So how can you tell, or can you tell, if a dog is getting cold? Are there physical signs you should look for?
Yeah, I mean, it's similar to people. You know, if you start seeing them shiver, you know, that's a sign that they're cold. You know, as far as their paws, you know, if their paws are getting cold, they'll tend to, you know, try to hold them up. You know, just like with people, you can see them, you know, start shaking, and it's just a natural response to being cold, is try to rev up their metabolic rate and kind of create more heat.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you brought the paws up.
Sure.
So I've seen the, like, booty shoes or whatever for dogs, which also make them lift up their paws, but probably for more confused reasons. So are those legit? Do dogs really need those?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it depends on how much activity they're doing outside. So, you know, some people, and not myself, but they like to still go with on walks with their dogs when it's, you know, 15 degrees. And so if you're, you know, still walking a mile when it's cold outside, it would be something to definitely consider, especially depending on where you're walking. So if you're in the street where there's been a lot of salt put down, it would be very good idea to protect your dog's paws from that, because of the irritants that can happen between the toes and things like that. And, you know, if they're just going outside for 5 minutes, do their business and come back in, I think they'll be okay.
Well, speaking of that idea of, you know, kind of going outside to do your business and coming back in versus walking a mile, as a vet who sees a lot of dogs, do you see that some of them tend to trend towards getting out of shape during the winter months, and then they have to be maybe put on a diet come New Year's, just like the rest of us?
Yeah, it's definitely common when we, you know, see an animal. Usually we get them in yearly, and sometimes every 6 months, but you can notice in March that, you know, they may have put on 5 or 10 pounds, just like us. You know, the less active you are, you're gonna gain some weight. So, you know, if they are, though, you know, outdoors a lot, that cold is actually stimulating them to burn more calories. And if you actually look at some of the you know, dogs who are raiding in the running in the Iditarod or something like that, they can burn through 10,000 calories in a day just from, you know, being active. So again, it does come down to, you know, how active the dog is.
So when you're meeting with clients, do you give any tricks or tips for just general winter safety at all?
I mean, it kind of comes back to just common sense. So, you know, if you wouldn't want to be outside, you know, for extended period of time in the weather, you know, make sure your dog's not. If they are an outdoor dog, make sure they have proper protection. So, you know, a dog house that's insulated, you know, go in there and check on it every once in a while. If you're putting in hay or something like that, that needs to be, changed out every once in a while, because it can get wet and then it's not as helpful in maintaining temperatures. So again, it just comes down to common sense that, you know, again, if it's cold and you're going to be cold from being out there for more than 5 minutes,
think about them too.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you work as a veterinarian at the Village Pet Doctor in Tolono. I'm kind of curious, as far as climate related visits throughout the year, Is it winter or summer that you see issues?
It's probably going to be more summer than anything. Again, most dogs can, you know, handle the cold, and most people are pretty cognizant of what, you know, could happen if they leave them out too long. But definitely more heat stroke is what we see, especially in the spring, because the dogs haven't assimilated what, you know, yet to the warmer weather. So, you know, we have some, you know, pretty extreme conditions in Illinois where it will change from, you know, being cold one day to being really warm the next day. And so it can take 10 to 20 days to really get used to the new temperature. So making sure that, you know, if the dog's been indoors all year long, even if you have like a 50 degree day in the spring, dogs can get heat stroke during that time.
Dang, okay.
So making sure that you can kind of keep track of them.
So much like we need that time to acclimate, they do as well. So very quickly, I know you don't have a dog, but I hear rumors you have guinea pigs.
I do. We have two.
Do you dress them up in winter coats?
We don't. They like to kind of hang out and hide all the time.
That's veterinarian Dr. Tony Kappa. He's with the Village Pet Doctor in Tolono, Illinois. Dr. Kappa, thanks so much for joining us. And thank you for joining us on the 21st. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. 21st is a production of the Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.